Your sheaves bow down to my sheaf. The stars and the sun and the moon bow down to me. We've seen something of the planned murder of Joseph, which then was graciously diminished into his sale into slavery. We've seen an overview of Genesis 38, something of the moral mess that his older brother Judah got into, living back in the proximity of his brothers and the proximity of true religion, yet he went off on his own, and this is what God had to do in striking two of his sons dead because they were so wicked. We've seen at the first part here of Genesis 39 something of the blessing on Joseph in being raised up from being that servant in the house, that new slave, to being raised up to being Potiphar's number one man. Potiphar didn't even need to concern himself with anything of all of his possessions concerning except for that which he would eat. Matthew Henry comments on the passage something to these words: I don't know of any other account that more fully displays the power of God in keeping someone in the midst of temptation. Now that quote right there ought to get our attention. I don't know of anything else in the Word of God that more marvelously displays the power of God in keeping someone in the midst of temptation. Yield not to temptation, for yielding is sin. Each victory will help you some other to win. Fight manfully onward, dark passions subdue. Look ever to Jesus. He will carry you through. Well, our first point as we consider the text, beginning at verse 7, is Joseph's great temptation. Roman numeral 1, Joseph's great temptation. And here we consider, first of all, A, the ironic timing of this great temptation. Joseph is one who goes through a cycle of highs and lows. He has his exalting dreams to have. Dad, what does this mean? Brothers, what do you think of this? He's then dropped into the low point of being sold into slavery. Then he's at the top of the roller coaster with his rise to being Potiphar's number one man. And from the high point there of verse 6, we see him dropping quickly again with his temptation and with Potiphar's wife in her intended ruin and destruction of Joseph. Matthew Henry comments, the hand of Satan, no doubt, was in it, who when he found he could not overcome Joseph with troubles and the frowns of the world, for in them Joseph held fast in his integrity, Satan assaulted him with the soft and charming pleasures, which have ruined more than the former, and have slain their 10,000s. I have been struck by the number of commentaries that have raised this whole issue of Satan's involvement. We look at the text and we don't see any mention of the devil. No words of Satan in the text. But these older writers are familiar enough with biblical truth to know that when there is a godly young man and there is a godless woman coming with this kind of attack, that Satan is in it. And certainly we are instructed that we ought not to be ignorant of his devices. If Satan can't get us with one device to pull us down and destroy us, then he'll try another. We are instructed in Ephesians 6 and verse 12. Well, verse 11. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day. there is evil that we face. There is evil that Joseph faced. And it is legitimate for us and for Joseph to recognize that there is an evil force called the devil that is often behind these intense temptations that we face. Well, we notice then, first of all, the ironic timing of the great temptation. He's gone through the difficulty. He's been left in that dry well, shivering and crying, pleading with his brothers. He's gotten out of that, and God has lifted him up and shown him a measure of blessing. And now he faces another temptation. There is never a point in our Christian lives where we may comfortably lean back in our rocking chair and take our ease and assume that all of the trials and difficulties that we are going to face in this world have already been faced. Until we check out, we are living in a sin-cursed world that is full of temptations. Secondly, B, notice with me the twofold occasion of the great temptation. The twofold occasion. First of all, it is Joseph's blessing from God in prosperity. Genesis 39 and verse 6, the first part. Thus he, Potiphar, left all that he had in Joseph's hand. And he did not know what he had except for the bread which he ate. One commentator writes, previously Potiphar's wife had not noticed Joseph. Now, there's a little bit of speculation that's involved in this. But as he was advanced in her husband's favor, he came to wear garments in keeping with his station, garments which set off the beauty of his person to advantage. But there is some reason to believe that in the early portion, he's this lowly slave. And maybe it's a little cute, maybe she didn't even notice him. But then it comes that he is brought into the house. Potiphar wants him in the house. He wants him close by. And as he advances, it is likely that then she comes to notice him, and her notice rapidly ripens into illicit desire. So Joseph's blessing from God in prosperity, he gets lifted up, and that becomes something of the occasion of this great temptation. Here is a noteworthy young man. She notices him, and that notice turns into sin on her part. But then secondly, the twofold occasion of the great temptation is Joseph's blessing from God in good looks. Who gave him his good looks? Genesis 39 and verse 6, the latter part. Now Joseph was handsome in form and in appearance. He's got a little bit of lineage of good looks. For Sarah, it is said of her, Abram says to her, indeed, I know that you are a woman of beautiful countenance. Therefore, it will happen when the Egyptians see you that they will say, this is his wife, and they will kill me, but they will let you live. Then in Genesis 26, Isaac has a similar scheme to hide his beautiful wife, Rebekah. And then, is it merely speculation to think in Genesis 34, this half-sister of Joseph, Dinah, was the one who drew all this attention of Shechem, the Hamor, of Hamor. Joseph was fair of form and fair of face. Only two other men are described this way in the Bible, David and Absalom. Again, Matthew Henry. Remarkable beauty, either of men or women, often proves a dangerous snare both to themselves and others, which forbids pride in it, and calls for a constant watchfulness against the temptation that attends it. If you're not beautiful, bless God for it. There are few less temptations that come with it. The Genevan. Whereas elegance of form was the occasion of great calamity to holy Joseph, let us learn not greatly to desire those graces of person which may draw the attention of the world, but rather let each be content with his own lot. We see how many dangers to how many dangers they are exposed who excel in beauty. Although in Joseph, religion so prevailed that he abhorred all impurity, yet Satan contrived a means of destruction for him from another quarter, just as he is accustomed to turn the gifts of God into snares whereby he may catch souls. Do you get the point of this? What is the twofold occasion of this great temptation? God's blessing of lifting him up in prosperity, and God's blessing of giving him good looks. And when we see the blessing of God on us, we ought to rejoice and say, isn't this wonderful that God is blessing here, that he's given a measure of prosperity, that he's blessing in this way? But just when we start congratulating ourselves with the blessing of God, then the devil comes along and he uses those very gifts to trip us up and lead us into temptation. We need to watch and pray. Thirdly, C, not only do we consider A, the ironic timing, and secondly, B, the twofold occasion of the great temptation, but thirdly, C, the sexual nature of the great temptation. Genesis 39 and verse 7, and it came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast longing eyes on Joseph, and she said, lie with me. Her sin began in the eye. Thus we see that the eyes were as torches to inflame the heart to lust. By which example we are taught that nothing is easier than for all our senses to infect our minds with depraved desires unless we are very earnestly on our guard. For Satan never ceases diligently to suggest those things which may incite us to sin. It's just a little thing that's out there. It goes into the eye. But the eye then, if it is not dealt with, it will stir us up to depraved desires. One has written, according to monumental evidence, Egyptian females, and here I'm leaving out of the quote the number of individuals that this man lists, from Herodotus, the ancient Greek historian, to others who have sifted through the evidence, Egyptian females, even though married, were distinguished for sexual immorality and were not condemned to live in seclusion, but were allowed to freely mix in promiscuous society, which facts perfectly account for Joseph's temptation by his master's wife. There was an ancient Egyptian document that has a number of lines that gives the account of two brothers. And the elder brother is married to this woman. The two brothers are out in the field. And the younger brother is sent back to the house to get some seed. And when he's there, the elder brother's wife makes a pass at him. And he gets away. And then by the time the elder brother, the husband of this woman, comes home, she convinces the older brother that it really was the younger brother who had made an advancement on her. And the story ends with the older brother sharpening his dagger to kill his younger brother based on the testimony of his immoral wife. Now, this is an account that is supposedly stored there among the ancient Egyptian documents over there in the British Museum in London. Something coming out of the 19th dynasty. But it gives us a little glimpse into what was likely going on there with Potiphar's wife. The Genevan again, the senses both readily embrace the occasion of sin which is presented to them, and the senses also eagerly and quickly convey it to the mind. Therefore, let everyone endeavor carefully to govern his eyes and his ears and the other members of his body, unless he wishes to open so many doors to Satan, to the innermost affection of his heart, and especially as the sense of the eyes is most vulnerable, no common care must be used in putting them under restraint. And brethren, this was written 500 years before the internet. How much more would caution be given if these men were aware of the ease of temptation that is available to us? We have a need to make a covenant with our eyes as Job of old. I have made a covenant with my eyes. Why then should I look upon a young woman? A covenant is a solemn oath. This is what I am saying I will not do. And for some of us, it means these are the practical steps that I am taking so that I can keep this word. This is what I am not going to do. Men, how are you doing with the covenant of your eyes? Are you doing as well these days as what you were 2 years ago or 4 years ago? How does the example of Joseph speak to you? Well, notice with me fourthly, D, the notable strength, having seen, thirdly, see the sexual nature. Now we come fourthly to the notable strength of the great temptation. Consider with me, first of all, we've got several lines of thought here under the notable strength. First of all, the power of physical sins among youth. There will be some abating of the influence of this kind of sin with lowered hormonal levels as we get older. Hence all the Viagra commercials aimed at a certain age group. Matthew Henry. The sin he was tempted to was physical uncleanness, which considering his youth, his beauty, his single state, and his plentiful living at the table of a ruler was a sin that one would think might most easily beset him and betray him. Now let's think back to Genesis 38. Why has God stuck Genesis 38 in the Bible? Here is Judah, who is there with his brothers, there with his father, there with the true religion. He's living with the family. He's got these influences if he wanted them, but he moves out and he's identifying with a Canaanite and he marries a Canaanite. And he's got sons that are so wicked, and there's this whole account of his getting involved mistakenly with Tamar, one of his widowed daughters-in-law. Contrast that to Holy Joseph, thousands of miles away from the true and family religion. And here he is, standing firm. He is a young man, he is not married, and yet he is committed to the principle of right. Secondly, there is a notable strength in the temptation. Secondly, in that the powerful person initiating the temptation. This was not some little servant girl who was walking by selling something out front of Potiphar's house. This was Potiphar's wife. You see it again, verse 7. That is master's wife. This is a woman who is powerful and daring and shameless in her sin. And if Joseph has been around this house for any length of time, he has a sense of what he's up against, who this woman is, and what this woman does when somebody crosses her will. The powerful person initiated the temptation. Thirdly, in this notable strength, thirdly, the danger of offending in temptation. Candlish writes, Joseph was too clear-sighted, and this is very closely related to the powerful person, but slightly different, the danger in offending in this temptation. Joseph was too clear-sighted not to perceive that such enticements if withstood, might or rather must turn to resentment and revenge. Satan, the prince of this world, having tried the wiles of flattery in vain, will turn to threats and violence. And if ever the promise of those early dreams of his, which he so simply told, and which his father counted so worthy of observation, if those dreams, the promise of those dreams is to be realized, it can only be through deeper shame and sorrow than he has yet endured. It can only be through much tribulation that he is going to enter into his glory. He is to be tried and perfected by suffering. Joseph would have been smart enough to know, if I cross this woman, and if God doesn't intervene, I'm likely in trouble. Fourthly, considering the notable strength of this temptation, what was he up against? The convenient opportunity in the temptation. He doesn't have to seek her out like the naive youth of Proverbs 7, does he? He says, okay, now where does that go? And then he goes down the street and he finds her. He says, no. He's living in the same house with this woman. Right there where he must live and work, it's not easy for him to avoid the occasion of sin. There's a proverb of old, opportunity makes a thief. Opportunity makes an adulterer. And that favored this temptation. The convenient opportunity. Fifthly, the intense importunity of the temptation. Verse 10. So it was as she spoke to Joseph day by day. I mean, why didn't she get the hint? Why didn't she take the message? She spoke to Joseph day by day that he did not heed her to lie with her or to be with her. Leupold writes, the shameless hussy was not in the least impressed by any of the higher considerations that Joseph sought to drive into her conscience. She was as persistent in her solicitations as he in his steadfastness. But he would not even be with her. Verse 11. But it happened about this time when Joseph went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the house was inside, that she caught him by his garment, saying, lie with me. But he left his garment in her hand and fled and ran outside. Her intensity was to such a degree that in the end, it went from the lustful looks. She's just noticing him. She's just casting longing eyes to the verbalization of her sin, to the actual grabbing hold of the young guy and saying, this is what we're going to do. Where exactly do you cross the line and come into attempted rape? This woman is after him in an amazing way. So much then for Roman numeral 1, the great temptation. We come secondly to consider Joseph's splendid victory. And oh to God, that would be stamped over our experience more and more. Your and my splendid victory. Consider with me, first of all, A, the reasons for Joseph's refusal. The reasons. And these reasons, three of them are given now in verse 8 and 9. We begin with the first. There in verse 8, the wrong of betraying a great trust. But he, Joseph, refused and said to his master's wife, look, my master does not know what is with me in the house and has committed all that he has to my hand. There is no one greater in this house than I, nor has he kept back anything from me but you. He is making reference here to the baseness of betraying so complete a trust. And this is what Joseph stresses first. Joseph is saying to us, the greater the confidence given, the baser the betrayal of it. There is a covenant of marriage. There is a level of trust. There is confidence. And it ought not to be betrayed. This one is looking to me in confidence. This one is looking to me as a believer in Jesus Christ. This one has entrusted me with certain privileges. And you know what oftentimes the carnal heart does? The carnal heart gets to looking at himself, gets to looking at myself and says, you know, I'm pretty big. I'm pretty important. I'm number one man in Potiphar's house. Aren't I special? Aren't I someone that is noteworthy? Why, I believe that I'm so important that I can sin and get away with it. Why, I believe I am so important, I, uniquely of all men, I am above the law. God's law is valid and it's true, but it's for the peons. It ain't for me. But you can see Joseph. He doesn't turn that in a carnal way of reasoning that I am so high up here on the pinnacle that the law of God does not reach up to me. But instead, he says, I have been given this place of honor and confidence and trust. And because I have been given this honor and trust, how could I dare betray this confidence? Brethren, we need to become more skilled in Joseph's thinking. Someone is looking to me. I have a testimony to maintain. I'm not going to do this sin so that the enemies of God are going to blaspheme my God. I'm not going to be a stumbling block to this young person. There is confidence that has been placed in me. And therefore, don't kid yourself, woman. I'm not even going there. If you're a dad, if you're a mom, if you are a Sunday school teacher, if you are a trusted employee, you better not let them down. Oh, it don't matter. They'll get over it. No. No. They may never get over it. Well, people ought to just look to the Lord and not look to man. Well, look at the reasoning that Joseph gives. There's a lot of confidence that has been placed in me, and I've been talking to my master about Jehovah, and he knows that it's Jehovah who has been blessing me, and I'm not about to mess that up. We are bound in honor as well as justice and gratitude, not in anything to injure those that have a good opinion of us and place a trust in us. However, secretly, the sin may be done. They'll never know. They'll never find out. Be sure. Your sin will find you out. So the first reason that he gives is the wrong of betraying a great trust. Secondly, now in verse 9, he speaks of, in this second reason, the sacredness of the marriage covenant. Nor has he kept anything back from me but you, because you are his wife. You are his wife. Does that ring a bell, Mrs. Potiphar? Does that bring back anything of your wedding day? And why does he say this, except that by recalling the religious obligation of marriage, he may wound the corrupt mind of the woman and may cure her of her insane passion? I have been given everything but you, and you are his wife. Proverbs 2:16, to deliver you from the immoral woman, from the seductress who flatters with her words, who forsakes the companion of her youth and forgets the covenant of her God. Malachi 2, now speaking to a man. Yet she is your companion and your wife by covenant. But did he not make them one? Leupold writes, Joseph emphasizes that the woman is withheld from him, Joseph, for she is Potiphar's wife. She may esteem this position rather lightly, still it involves obligations. I just read a couple days ago, 13-year-old girls are being assured by the experts that there's nothing morally deviant about their having already had multiple partners. The girls are not to be deprived of their fun. God has a righteous standard. Men, are you rightly valuing your wife by covenant and your companion of youth? Drink water from your own cistern and running water from your own well. Should your fountains be dispersed abroad, streams of water in the streets, let them be only your own and not for strangers with you. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice with her, the wife of your youth, as a loving deer and as a graceful doe. Let her satisfy you at all times and always be enraptured with her love. For why should you, my son, be enraptured by an immoral woman and be embraced in the arms of a seductress? For the ways of a man are before the eyes of Jehovah, and he, Jehovah, ponders all his paths. His own iniquities entrap the wicked man, and he is caught in the cords of his sin. He shall die for lack of instruction, and in the greatness of his folly he shall go astray. You are his wife. And the third reason that Joseph gives, now in the latter part of verse 9, is the reason of the affront of rebellion against God. It's not just Joseph, is it? It's Joseph as he is a servant of Jehovah. Verse 9. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? You see, many times this kind of impurity is just portrayed as, well, it's just a little bit of youthful indiscretion. Youthful experience. Really wouldn't want to call it sin. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? Notice where he begins. How can I who am a believer and the living and the true God, I who have been talking to Potiphar about Jehovah this and Jehovah that, and even Potiphar now is talking, well, it's Jehovah that is blessing everything to do. I who have known the presence of my God even as I live in a foreign land. I who do not deserve the mercies of the Lord to him, to me, but he's with me. How can I do this great wickedness and sin? Others may view it as just the kind of stuff that young people do. Matthew Henry. In general, when any time we are tempted to sin, we must consider the great wickedness that there is in the sin. Let sin appear as sin. Call it by its name. Paul writes in Romans 7, but sin that it might appear sin. Turn with me, if you would, to Proverbs 6 and verse 25. Some in our day speak of this, well, it's not really wrong, it's not really deviant behavior. Others say, well, it's just a youthful experience and they'll get over it and they'll forget about it and there's no real consequence to it. It's not really wrong. But Joseph refers to it as great wickedness and sin. Proverbs 6 and verse 25. Do not lust after her beauty in your heart, nor let her allure you with her eyelids. For by means of a harlot, a man is reduced to a crust of bread, and an adulteress will prey on his precious life. Can a man take fire to his bosom and his clothes not be burned? Can one walk on hot coals and his feet not be seared? So is he who goes into his neighbor's wife. Whoever touches her shall not be innocent. People do not despise a thief if he steals to satisfy himself when he is starving. Yet when he is found, he must restore sevenfold. He may have to give up all the substance of his house. Whoever commits adultery with a woman lacks understanding. He who does so destroys his own soul. Wounds and dishonor he will get, and his reproach will not be wiped away. For jealousy is a husband's fury. Therefore he will not spare in the day of vengeance. He will accept no recompense, nor will he be appeased, though you give many gifts. Almost like Joseph had been reading Proverbs chapter 6, although Proverbs 6 hadn't been written yet. How can I do this great wickedness and sin, now the third part of his reasoning, against God? Not only how shall I do this wickedness against my master, against you, my master's wife, against my own soul, against my own body, but how can I do this great sin and this wickedness against my God? Gracious souls look on this as the worst thing in sin, that it is against God. Against his nature, against his dominion, against his love, and against his design. Evidently, Joseph had spoken of Jehovah to his master. We saw last Lord's Day morning how frequently Jehovah the Lord appears in those first six verses. And now what's he saying here in verse 9? And sin against Elohim, the more general term for God. Here, to this sinful woman whose spiritual insight is more limited, he speaks merely of God. Well, we see then something of the reasons, the three of them, the reasons of Joseph's refusal. Now, secondly, B under Roman numeral 2, the manner. The manner of Joseph's refusal is not only that he said the right thing here, that he had the right reasons in his mind and was able to recount those. But notice the manner of his refusal. First of all, Joseph was prompt in his refusal. Verse 8, the temptation comes in verse 7, verse 8, but he refused. And he said to his master's wife, and here it is. Verse 11, it happened about this time when Joseph went into the house. And she grabs hold of him, speaks to him, the latter part of verse 12. But he left his garment in her hand and fled and ran outside. He is prompt in his refusal. He's not standing around saying, oh, well, let me think about this for a moment. There's really nothing for him to think about. Is this right or is it wrong? It is wrong before my God. It is great wickedness before my God. It is a betrayal of trust. I'm out of here. 2 Timothy 2:22, flee also youthful lusts. Owen writes, rise mightily against the first actings of your imbalance. Its first conceptions. Suffer it not to get the least ground. Do not say, thus far the sin shall go and no further. If it have allowance for one step, it will take another. It is impossible to fix bounds to sin. All right, I'll just let the sin go this far. And then I'm going to step in and I'm going to nip the bud and we'll deal with it then. It is like water in a channel. If it once break out, it will have its course. Its not acting is easier to be stopped than its bounding. It's easier to just say, no, we're not even going to start here, then let the thing build up some momentum and some inertia and get your own heart and your own affections wrapped up in it, then you're in trouble. Then when desire is conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is full grown, brings forth death. Owen, once again. Consider what an unclean thought would have. What's its goal? What's its end? It would have you roll yourself in folly and filth. Ask envy what it would have. Murder and destruction is at the end of it. Set yourself against temptation to less heinous sin with no less vigor than if the temptation had utterly debased you to wickedness. Without this, you will not prevail. As sin gets ground in the affections to delight in it, sin also gets the understanding to slight the sin. You see what he's saying? You can't let this thing get going. And if you won't deal with the first movements of the sin as if it really intends to destroy you, then you're not going to win. Had Joseph hesitated, Whitelaw comments, had Joseph hesitated, he might have been lost. Had he trifled with the forbidden fruit, he might have plucked and eaten. Joseph was prompt in his refusal. Joseph was kind in his refusal. He commends the generosity of Potiphar with a design to bring Potiphar's wife back to his senses. He is kind by seeking to say, "You're his wife. Doesn't that mean anything to you?" Joseph was not only kind and prompt, he was brave in his refusal. He likely knew something about people if he was being so quickly advanced. And he likely knew something about this lady and what she would do if he did not bow to her will. He was brave. In a sense, he said, "I don't care. I don't care. She can kill me. I'm not going to sin." Joseph was firm in his refusal. He did not heed her to lie with her or to be with her. He left his garment in her hand and fled and ran outside. There's no sound of wavering or indecision in his refusal. He is firm. Again, Whitelaw. It was not the answer of man who was only half-hearted in putting away from him a thing which he secretly desired. "Oh, no, I couldn't do that. Oh, no, I couldn't do that. Well, I don't think I could do that." There's no wavering here. In Joseph's no, there was a clear, full-toned ring of a man who had made up his mind intelligently, and finally, the matter is resolved. The danger for us is, once we think we've got the issue resolved, temptation comes around, tries to come through a different window. When you are tempted, you have to define the temptation in terms of God's law. This is where you need to be black and white. If the temptation is something that is black and white, then say, "All right, that would be adultery. That would be a lie. That would be a form of murder." And sometimes just stating it in that kind of black and white is a great help to us. I was thinking in terms of, what do you do when you confess your sins? Homologeo, confess. It means to say the same thing as. So after we've done the sin, we got to go to God and we got to say the same thing about the sin as what God says about the sin. I was thinking, you know what? If we would say the same thing about the sin before we did it, we wouldn't do it. if we looked at it in God's eye and saw the right and wrong and saw the consequences and so on, we could save ourselves a lot of heartache, couldn't we? Preacher, talking a lot about sin, temptation. It's kind of a negative theme here this morning. Hebrews chapter 12. I want a Christianity that just tells me to look unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. Now, I can feel real good about that. But you're talking about Joseph and his temptation and his sin here. Well, let's look at Hebrews 12 and verse 2. Looking unto Jesus, the author and the finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. He sat down. The work is done. He has accomplished redemption. Wonderful verse. But what does verse 3 say? For consider him, Jesus Christ, who endured such hostility from sinners against himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls. You have not resisted to bloodshed, striving against sin. Okay. Look unto Jesus. But as you look unto Jesus, you look at one who maintained absolute purity. And as you look unto Jesus, and as I look unto Jesus, we have the encouragement to go ahead and strive against sin, even to the point of shedding blood. I don't care if she kills me. I'm not giving in. To close this morning, I want you to know that you need to be a true Christian in order to deal with sin. We've got to deal with sin. The third stanza of that hymn that we sang, Yield Not to Temptation. To him that overcometh, God giveth a crown. Through faith we shall conquer, though often cast down. He who is the Savior, our strength will renew. Look ever to Jesus. He will carry you through. You cannot and you will not overcome if you are not in union with Jesus Christ. Paul writes in 2 Timothy 3 of those who have a form of godliness but deny its power. And what he's talking about, they've got a form of religion, and yet by their lives it's evident that they don't have any power that's coming through them, enabling them to change and to move away from their various addictions, their various enslavements to sin. And maybe there's someone sitting here this morning who has religion. They've got a form of it, but they've got no power to deal with the addictions of their past. My hear. What you need more than anything else is to start not out here with this little sin that you've got, but you've got to start in here at the core of your being. I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit within you. I will take the heart of stone out of your flesh and give you a heart of flesh, one that beats for God. And what's going to happen? I will put my spirit within you and cause you to walk in my statutes, and you will keep my judgments, and do them. If you're sitting here this morning and you're seeing that you're enslaved to this and you've got this problem and you've got the other and you don't seem to be making any progress whatsoever, then maybe you've got the form of religion, but you don't have the power of it. You need the power of it. You need the new heart. But maybe you're a true believer, struggling with indwelling sin, even as the Apostle Paul. For the good that I will to do, I do not do. But the evil I will not to do, that I practice. Now, if I do what I will not to do, it is no longer I who do it, but the sin that dwells in me. I find then a law that evil is present with me, the one who wills to do the good. What do? We follow right along with our hand in the Apostle Paul. We're believers, but the struggle is going on within us. And we move From Romans 7, verse 24, O wretched man that I am, who will deliver me from this body of death? To verse 1 of Romans 8, there is therefore now no condemnation to those who are in Christ Jesus, who do not walk according to the flesh, but according to the Spirit. We're not going to reach perfection in this life. But if we're seeing that the Spirit of God is day by day moving us towards godliness, transforming us, then we can take encouragement and hope that the Spirit of God is indeed dealing with us, that we are the child of God. The basis of our acceptance is not how well we are doing. The basis of our acceptance with God is that we are trusting in the full and complete righteousness of Jesus Christ. Let's pray.